Day minus 5426. 0700. Jen is in a different bed. She knows it the same way she knows it's roughly 7 o'clock in the morning, the same way she knows when somebody has been discussing her just before she enters a room, or that a car is about to pull out in front of her. Micro-emotions, are they called that? The abilities humans have to detect small changes. You can't explain it, you just know. Todd would call it the hindsight paradox, she supposes. The light looks different. That's the first tell. No blinds at the bay window. Instead, the room is cast in a grey light, filtered fuzzily through curtains. It must be the winter. A radiator nearby is on. She can smell the hot metal of it, feel the artificial heat mingling with the chill in the air above the bed. The mattress feels different. Old and lumpy from when they had less money. Funny how you get used to having money. It seems easy. You forget what it's like to live without it, to sleep on shitty mattresses and save up for takeaways. She's alone. She lies there in the grey light, just blinking and exhaling a long breath, afraid to look. She runs a hand down her side, underneath the covers. Yep, prominent hip bones. She is much younger. Right. She steals herself, then gets out of bed. The carpet. She knows it instantly. The carpet orients her straight away. She is in her favourite house, the tiny house that sits alone in the valley. She's chilled by this, to be alone with a man whose identity is fake. She reaches down to find a mobile phone and is at least glad there is one there waiting for her. She breathes, then checks the date. It is 15 years prior. It is 2007. December the 21st. Jen feels like she might be sick. This is fucked up. This is completely and utterly fucked up. She has a 3-year-old. She's 28. A giant leap back, skipping age 13 to 3? Jen is suddenly so angry that this has happened to her. She strides to the window, wanting to wrench it up, to scream out into the country air, to do something, anything, and oh, there it is. Her favourite view. Still in their nomadic, off-grid phase with Kelly before Todd needed to be settled at a school. In the little house in the valley, a monopoly hotel of a house where they never saw anybody. Maybe it's that. Maybe this life was damaging for him, too isolated. She rests her head on the window instead of screaming out of it. How the fuck should she know? There are no fucking clues. Her angry breath mists up the window. Give me a tell, she thinks, staring at the vapour. It clears off and she looks out. The beauty of the stark landscape, sepia brown in the winter wilderness. The hills look old, tatty. Proper, untended, wild countryside. Long, blonde, beachy grasses. She had loved it here, and now she's back. She pulls a dressing gown around her, over a pair of tartan pyjamas she doesn't remember even owning. She can hear Todd and Kelly in the living room, loud chatter. She isn't ready yet to go and see them. Her body remembers the layout of the bungalow. She heads right into the bathroom before going through to see them. She needs to see herself first, to know what to expect. She looks at the miniature strip light above the mirror. Her hand instinctively reaches to tug hard on it. She knows it will resist, that it is stiff, that later it breaks entirely. With a ping, she is illuminated. It's Jen from photographs. It's Jen from her wedding day. Jen has looked back at this Jen often, thought wistfully that she didn't know how great she looked. She'd focused on her strong nose, her wild hair, but look. Bright, clear skin, cheekbones, youth. You can't fake it. There isn't a single line on her face while it is at rest. She brings a hand to her skin, which yields like bread dough, springy and full of collagen, not the crepe paper that awaits her at 40. Jen turns to the door. She can still hear them. She knows that she will find them in the living room, in the December half-light. Jen, Kelly calls. Yeah, she says, and her voice is higher and lighter than it is in 2022. He wants you, Kelly calls, his voice imbued with a harassed tone she remembers well. They were so swept up in it, in the demands of parenting a small child. The Jen of now can hardly remember why it was so difficult, can't recall the exact details, only that it was. Only the way her calf muscles ached in bed at night. Only the evidence that remained, toast still in the toaster, uneaten, forgotten in the chaos, washing hung out at midnight, smelling of damp from too much time in the machine. Weird bodge jobs to make life easier. One time they put a playpen up around the television to stop Todd turning it off all the time. Things they knew to be kind of mad, but did anyway. Things they did just to get by. I'm here, she says, turning the light out in the bathroom and stepping into the hallway. There they are. Jen's eyes tracked to Todd, the Todd from her memories. Her son, 3 years old, barely a foot and a half high. Jen's face, Kelly's eyes, fat little hands outstretched towards her. Todd the toddler, she says, his nickname rolling easily off her tongue. You're up. He's been up since five, Kelly says, pulling his hair back from his hairline. He raises his eyebrows to her. She's shocked by how much it's receded in the present day. Shocked by other things, too. His face is boyish. She finds him less attractive in his 20s than in his 40s, she is surprised to find. He's fatter here, too. They had a lot of takeaways, didn't exercise. Any time to themselves was hard won, so precious that they spent it in blissful sitting silence. Go back to bed if you want, she offers. She walks down the hallway to the door. Cold is seeping in from underneath it, an icy backwash. She wants to see the view properly. Her hands, so young, so unlined, remember the knack for opening the Yale lock and pressing the handle at the same time, and she pulls it open and, ah, finds her valley. It's your day for a lie-in, Kelly says automatically from behind her. Yes, that's right, they alternated the lie-ins religiously. It's fine, she says with a wave of her hand, with all the concern of somebody only here for the day. A babysitter, a nanny, somebody who can give the baby back. It's frosty out. They have a wreath on their door which she fingers absent-mindedly. Wellies outside, a stone porch, milk bottles. They had an old-fashioned milkman. And then the valley. Two hills meeting in an X. Dusted with the cold, like icing sugar. It smells delicious out here. Smoke and pine and frost, menthol, like the air itself, has been cleaned. Satisfied, she closes the door and turns back to Todd, who is walking towards her. When he reaches her, she bends to him, and he moves his face into her shoulder. And it is as seamless a motion as a long-forgotten dance. Her body remembers him, her baby, in all of his guises. 3, 15, 17, and a criminal. She loves them all. Go back to bed, she says, looking at Kelly. He gives her a warm half-smile. I feel like I've shot out of a cannon, not just woken up, he says, yawning and stretching. He doesn't go, though. Like with most things in parenthood, he wanted support, to be understood, rather than for her to take over. He sinks onto the sofa. She turns back to her son, with this person who today, on the shortest day of the year, 2007, she has got to fix, so that as the clocks go back in 2022, he doesn't kill somebody. The room is littered with toys she had forgotten about. The little yellow ice cream truck, the Fisher-Price garage inherited from her parents. A Christmas tree sparkles in the corner, an old artificial one that might still sit in their loft in Crosby to this day. The living room is dim, lit only by the fairy lights. Now, Jen says, drawing back from Todd and looking at him in his tiny dungarees. He stares back at her wordlessly in that soulful way that he used to. Inky eyes, snub nose, pink cheeks, a studious expression on his face. She holds up a wooden block and he takes it very seriously from her, then drops it onto the floor. "Shall we pile them up?" Jen says. Todd stretches his hand out very, very slowly. "As tense as a hostage negotiation," Kelly says. "What is it they say? Toddlers don't play, they go to work." "Ha, yeah. I was obsessed with blocks when I was a kid." "Oh?" Kelly leans back on the sofa, putting his legs up over one arm. He closes his eyes. "Would have thought you'd be, I don't know, on the flashcards, you know, always learning." "Really not," Jen says. "It took ages for me to read." "I don't believe that, you wordy lawyers. You're all the same," he drawls, and Jen smiles in surprise. He was more acerbic like this. In 2022, he's still dry, but here, Kelly comes complete with a chip on his shoulder. She'd forgotten how much he used to moan about work, come up with various business ideas and abandon them. He seemed to want to succeed, then chicken out. "What's on these flashcards, then?" she says. "Definition of jurisprudence, for starters. One should know this by age 2 at the latest." "Of course, and what is that, Kelly, age?" Jen hesitates. 28. "Good at English, less so at maths," Kelly says, quick as a flash. 29. "Forgotten my age already? You know me." Todd laughs suddenly out of nowhere and claps at Kelly. "Yes, yes," he says to him. "What was yours?" Jen asks him, thinking of how she felt in the back of the car with him as they got pulled over, trying to reach that part of him that perhaps she never has. "My what? Favourite toy?" "Can't remember." Kelly shifts on the sofa, eyes still closed. "What did you want to be when you grew up?" Kelly sits up on an elbow, looking at her sardonically, emotional unavailability coloured across his features. How can Jen have missed this? "Why?" "Just wondering. I've never known. And we're so far from where you grew up. You know, I don't think I've ever met anyone who used to know you." "They're all so far away. My mum always wanted me to be a manager," he says, changing the topic. "Isn't that funny?" "A manager of what?" Jen is stacking the blocks up in front of Todd, who has his hands clasped in anticipation, but really she is thinking how evasive Kelly can be. "Literally anything. That's what she wanted. After our dad disappeared. He corrects himself, glancing at Todd. "All she wanted for us was stability. To her, a boring office job, one holiday a year, a mortgage on a little place." "And you did the opposite," Jen says. But internally she's thinking, our dad. Our dad. The man in the photograph with Kelly's eyes. She knew she hadn't imagined the resemblance. She blinks, shocked. He avoids her gaze. "Yeah? You said our dad." No, my. You said our. I didn't, Jen sighs. He will stonewall her if she asks further. She'll have to try something else. I wish he could have met your mum, she says softly to him, and mine. Oh, same. How old were you when she died again? Jen asks, wondering why this feels dangerous, tentative. This man is her fucking husband, for God's sake. 20. And you last saw your dad when you were, God knows, 3, 5? It must have been so, to be an only child and then no parents. Yeah. Do you think she'd have liked me and Todd? Of course. Look, gonna take you up on that offer, he says. Bed calls. He leans down and kisses her, full on the lips, the only thing that hasn't changed between 2007 and now, and then saunters off to bed, leaving Jen alone with Todd. Something makes Jen leave Todd in the living room with the blocks and follow Kelly down the drab, brown-carpeted hallway. She reaches their bedroom, one ear still listening out for Todd, and stops by the door. Kelly isn't in the bedroom, not that she can see, anyway. She edges the door open in the half-light and creeps in. Nothing. Well, where is he then? She moves forwards across the room. The strip light is on in the bathroom. Did she leave it on? Just as she's standing there, wondering what to do, she hears a sound. a quiet, anguished sort of sound, like somebody trying to keep something in. He's in there. She moves towards the bathroom door and peers inside. And there is her husband of 20 years sitting on the toilet lid, his head in his hands, sobbing. The only time Jen has ever seen him cry. "Kelly?" she says. He jumps, wiping hurriedly at his eyes with his fists. The backs of his hands come away wet. He looks so like Todd when he cries, bottom lip going and all. Jen's whole body feels heavy and sad as she watches him try to cover it up. "I've got this cold, it's making my eyes stream," Kelly says. It's a ridiculous lie. Jen wonders how many of them he's told, and why. But look at him now, she thinks sadly. It's the same look. It's the same look he gives her in 15 years' time when their son kills somebody. Heartbreak. What's the matter? "No, nothing, honestly, it's this bloody cold. I hope it's gone for Christmas." "Is this about your mum?" Jen says, her voice low. "Is Todd all right? Is he..." "He's in the living room. He's fine." Jen moves across the tiny bathroom to Kelly. He stays where he is, on the toilet lid. But Jen moves in alongside him, putting her hand across his back and guiding him towards her. To her surprise, he lets her, his arm coming around the back of her legs, his head resting against her chest. "It's okay," she says gently to him, the way she would to Todd. "It's okay to be upset. It's just this..." "Your Christmas cold, I know," Jen says, letting him live the lie, whatever it is, letting him believe it. Something he said to her in 2022 comes to her about a divorcing couple. Avoiding pain is priceless to some. After a few minutes, Kelly releases her. He looks across at Jen as she leaves to go and check on Todd and says one single sentence to her. "I just miss her. My mum." It seems to cost him a lot. His body convulses as he says it. Jen nods quickly, and there it is, something her husband, for some reason, has not ever been able to show her. "I know," she says, and she does know, motherless herself. "Thank you for telling me," she says. Kelly gives her a watery smile, his black hair everywhere. His eyes look especially blue. And here, back in the past, something passes between them, something more substantial than what has gone before, something Jen can't even name, but something which goes some way towards igniting some hope within her that Kelly isn't what he appears to be. Please let that be so. Jen walks back to Todd in the living room. It is old-fashioned, green, worn carpet, dark wood furniture. It has a specific smell to it, a comforting, homely sort of smell. Cinnamon, sugar, cookies, a blown-out candle somewhere. Jen guesses that somewhere or other an alternative version of her was baking last night. Funny how these things felt so important then. Go and see the Christmas lights, bake and assemble the gingerbread house, and poof, they disappear into history, causing only stress and leaving no imprint, like a footstep on sand that gets washed away too swiftly. Her entire life, she's been so concerned with how things seem to be. Keeping up appearances, having it all, the house with the carved pumpkin so everybody knew they'd done it. And yet, what was it all for? Todd plays with his cars for a few minutes, then toddles over to the other side of the room. "No, Toddy, not that," she says, as he dives suddenly into the bin. He ignores her, pulling out two balls of tin foil from what was perhaps a Kit Kat. Jen is disappointed that irritation flares up so easily on just a single day with him. "Mine," Todd says, his hurt little eyes gaze at her across the room. "More," he adds. He turns to the bin again. He's practically upside down, his head at the bottom of the bin, his feet almost rising off the floor. "Sorry, Todd, come here," she says. "Come to Mummy." Todd turns to her the second he hears the very first syllable fall from her lips, like a flower to his son, and looks at her. And suddenly, just like that, like a light going on, she knows, deep in her stomach, deep inside her. She knows because of the way his eyes catch the early morning blue winter light. It isn't her fault. It isn't his fault. She knows that she mothered him well enough. She knows because of his eyes. They are lit with love. They are lit with love for her. She deflates right there on the sofa. She tried her best, and even when she didn't, the guilt is as much evidence as anything else. She wanted to do her best for him, her baby boy. The hindsight paradox that this very person here teaches her about in a decade's time. She thought she knew it would happen, self-blamed, thought he'd killed because of a poor relationship with her. But he doesn't. It was an illusion. And so this is the moment Jen realizes that it isn't about this. It's not about Todd's childhood at all. "Come here, Toddy," she says. Immediately he drops the balls of foil from the bin and he comes to her, his mother. Ryan. Ryan is finally about to meet him, the man in charge of the operation, the big guy. He will have hundreds of foot soldiers, of associates, multiple ops. The car thefts, the drugs, the stolen baby, they're only a tiny part of it. Ryan doesn't know how the houses he targets are always empty, and he doesn't yet know where baby Eve has gone, but he's working it all out. And look, here, walking in the cold to a warehouse in Birkenhead, he's infiltrated all the way to the top. Angela and Ryan have been instructed by Ezra to meet him here 8 o'clock at night. After you meet the boss, you get given better jobs, more important jobs, and crucially, better intel. Ryan's gone in wired for the first time on a wing and a prayer that the big boss won't check him over. Leo says he won't, says you don't meet the boss without trust. "Even if he intimates it," Leo said last night on the phone, "you act so fucking offended he's quaking." "Too right," Ryan had said. Not the sort of sentence he would usually say. Sometimes he feels like he is becoming the person he is pretending to be. Darker, more volatile. Ryan and Angela walk in silence for a few minutes more, watching cars being loaded and unloaded onto ships, people coming and going. As they near the warehouse, their body language changes. Angela becomes Nicola. Ryan watches it happen. Her walk becomes a swagger. Her mannerisms change. Ryan doesn't know how his own body language changes, only that it does. The warehouse has no sign up above it. It's closed down, the perfect place for these sorts of dealings. Ryan hopes it has good acoustics for the team who are listening in, gathering evidence with which to incriminate. Ryan knocks twice on the dark green roller-shuttered door, as directed, then waits. Angela is trembling. She isn't as together as she first appears. Ryan thinks she is just as shit-scared as he is. Of course, it has occurred to him that this could be it, a sting. They could be rumbled. They could be done for. Somehow, Ryan doesn't care. And when he feels he does, he thinks of her, baby Eve, lost and alone, not at sea, but as good as. "In," says a voice from around the side. Ryan and Angela move around the edge of the building and find a door propped open, allowing the outside security light to illuminate a shaft of the warehouse. It's otherwise empty, rows and rows and rows of floor-to-ceiling shelving containing nothing. In the expanse of the huge room stands a tall man, younger than Ryan expected. He isn't moving at all, just standing, arms folded, wearing all black clothes. He has dark hair and a goatee. "The two musketeers," he says. He tosses the end of a cigarette which embers at his feet for a few seconds before fizzling to nothing. "Got a job for you. Need you to collect a list of empty properties. Going to send you an address now." Almost instantaneously, Ryan's burner phone beeps with a single line of text from, yes, an actual number. It's an address on a high street in Liverpool. This is it. This man in charge of it all is going to trust them with how he gets his intel about which cars to steal. "You await further instructions," he says to them. "Cool, thanks, mate," Ryan says, altering the cadence of his natural voice. The man tilts his head back. "Where you from?" Manchester. He makes an impatient gesture. Before that. Always Manchester, but got a Welsh dad, he says. It's the truth. They decided he should stick to this rather than try out an accent. You? The man asks Angela. Yeah, round here, she says in perfect Scouse, even though she is from Lee. Undercover officers are not often local. Too much chance someone would know them, blow their cover. The man crosses the warehouse to them, black boots crunching the grit and grime on the floor. It's Joseph, he says, extending a hand to Ryan, then to Angela. Nicola, she says. Joseph holds his hands up. My standard warning, if you double-cross me, if you dob me in, if you're DS, if you slip up, I will do the time, and then I will fucking come and kill you, okay? Likewise, Ryan says. Let's shake on it then, Joseph says. Kelly, Ryan says, as he grasps Joseph's hand. Good to meet you. Kelly, the alias Ryan had to choose for himself. Something you turn your head to, Leo advised. Something familiar. That's the first test they do to check you're not coppers. Call your name in a bar, see if your head swivels. I'd always answer to my brother's name, Ryan had said in a low voice, thinking of the night his brother got in too deep, owed so much money, so many favours, the night his brother tied the noose. They'd found him too late, by about half an hour, the coroner later said. He'd done it in the loft. He hadn't wanted to be found. Day minus 6,998, 0800. Jen is in a two-up, two-down terrace. She and Kelly rented it for a year. They had no emotional connection to it at all. Jen hardly remembers it. It is only now, looking up at the ceiling marbled with damp, that she recalls living here at all. Jen is not yet pregnant, and so Todd is not yet born, which leaves only one person this mystery can be about. Lopez? Kelly calls up the stairs. Emotion moves up through her. She'd forgotten he went through a phase of calling her that. Jen became Jenny from the block after that song, then became Lopez. Kelly, she says, you're up. I am. Look, he says in that way that he does, that authoritative, guarded way. I have a thing today. What's that? An all-day conference. Something vague is stirring in Jen's mind. What kind of painted decorator goes to a last-minute conference? One she trusted, she supposes. Sure, she says, but the ground underfoot as she rises from bed feels unstable, like it's made of quicksand. You'll be gone all day? Yeah, Kelly says distractedly. Okay. You look like you've seen a ghost. Kelly's eyes are the same, but not much else. He's so slim, elegant almost. I'm fine, Jen says weakly, looking up at him. Don't worry, you go. You sure? Sure can be. Jen doesn't hesitate at all in following Kelly. They're rushing towards the moment she cracks it open, she can tell. She's here in the back of a cab. It was much harder to call a taxi this far back in the past. She has a mobile, but it's an old brick, whose numbers illuminate green neon and sing as she touches them. A children's toy of a phone. Can we stop here? Jen says. Kelly has parked illegally right in the centre of Liverpool on double yellows. His car is a Y-Reg. Jen hadn't realised quite how much cars had changed. It's boxy, looks too big. She can't stop looking at it, or him. She feels like an alien. Kelly looks left and right as he unfolds his long legs out of the driver's seat. The checking seems habitual, a tick. Blue eyes flick up and down the street. She remains in her black cab. She will be almost invisible to Kelly here, sheltered in the back behind a grimy window. Got to get a move on soon, the cabbie says. Just five minutes, please. I just need to watch something, she says. The taxi driver doesn't answer her. Instead, pointedly gets a novel out, John Grisham, the pages folded down. He leaves the engine idling. Oh, the days when people read novels to pass the time. Sorry, won't be long, she adds, thinking of all the things she could tell this man about the future. Brexit, the pandemic. Nobody would believe her. It's mind-blowing. a whole 2 decades squashed here into a taxi with them. Kelly moves around to the back of his car. He scans the horizon in that way he sometimes still does in the present day. She'd never thought about it much until forced to observe her husband in this way. His hair is gelled carefully, coiffed at the front. Another driver honks at them, gesturing at the taxi as he drives past. He winds his window down. "Move!" he yells. Jen's driver puts the car into gear. "One sec, please, please," she says. If she gets out now, Kelly will see her, and it will all be for nothing. Kelly opens the boot with one hand and pulls something out. It's large and burgundy, some folded material. Curtains, maybe? Jen rests her forehead against the mucky window of the taxi, squinting. It's a suit bag. Jen recognizes it from years ago. He wore suits very occasionally, to funerals, to weddings. It hung on a hook in the back of their wardrobe. "Anytime, love," the taxi driver says, but Jen just nods. Kelly disappears up a side road, his stride a study in casual walking that Jen knows to be false. She's going to lose him. "I need to go," she says. She starts to gather her bag and purse, trying not to lose sight of him. As she's counting out the money she got out of the drawer in the kitchen, different drawer, different kitchen, different notes, another car honks their horn. "Hang on," the taxi driver says. "I'll go. I need to go," Jen says, almost shouting. "We're blocking a bus route." "I need to get out," Jen yells. She fiddles with the car door handle as the honking continues, wondering what will happen if she just cuts and runs without paying. It's only a taxi. It's barely a crime. She thrusts too many notes into the silver tray that has actual cigarette ash in. God, yes, people used to smoke everywhere, and leaps out. She dashes to the side street. Kelly has almost reached the end of it. He stands out to her in a crowd the same way Todd does, the same way her own name does on a list. He turns abruptly left and goes into a pub called the Sundance. He's holding his suit bag still over his arm, so Jen hedges her bets and waits nearby on the pavement. She stands outside Woolworths, the red and white sign so familiar to her. It goes bust in just 5 years' time. The recent past, really, but it doesn't feel it. Inside, the sealed, plasticky floors, the stationery. She could stay here forever, just looking in through the window, marvelling at times gone by. Christmases buying games and pick and mix, just staring at the changes that have overtaken the world over the last 20 years. The things lost and gained. She raises a palm to the glass, just as she did right at the very beginning of this, and waits. Reflected behind her, she sees Kelly emerge from the pub. He's now wearing the suit, the bag slung back over his arm, hair freshly gelled, black shiny shoes on. A woman seems to come out of nowhere, perhaps another pub, perhaps an alleyway. Jen watches her approach Kelly. She squints. It's Nicola. "How was it?" Kelly says to her. "Yeah, all right, tough. They want to know all the methods." Kelly guffaws. "We can't say those." "I know, I said that. Judge didn't much like it. Listen, good luck. And call me, you know, if, in the future, you ever want to come back." Nicola leaves Kelly there in the street without another word. Jen gazes at him, unseen now in the crowds, thinking of the texts he sends Nicola in 20 years' time, asking for help, of the fact that she asks for something in return from him. Jen follows Kelly at a distance, grateful that it's Liverpool and not Crosby. She marvels at the fashions, flared jeans, boho tops exposing skin to the last of the summer sun in September, and the old cars and shops, the world filtered vintage. Kelly walks with purpose but also with anxiety, Jen thinks, his head upright, a deer being pursued, or a lion in pursuit, she isn't sure which. Down a cobbled street past brands that have and haven't survived the last 20 years, Debenhams, Blockbusters, into a strip-lit bright mall full of jewellers out the other side, left, right, up a side street lined with industrial-sized bins. Jen drops back even further. His pace slows on a wide, pedestrianised swathe of grey paving slabs. He's surrounded by tall buildings. His body turns completely towards one of them, and then he walks forward, pulls the door open, and disappears. Jen doesn't need to look at a map or read the signs. She, a lawyer, knows this building well. How could she not? It's Liverpool Crown Court. Outside, there are old-fashioned street lamps, the bulbs spherical and white like pearls. The building is no different back here in 2003. A large 70s cuboid sprawl, dark brown cladding, tinted windows, an embossed crest on the front. For once, she's glad of the justice system that never changes, creaking and ancient and fusty. She waits in the sun for a few minutes, then follows Kelly inside, pulling open the glass double doors to the courthouse. She heads straight to the listings, glad of the legal knowledge that she has. They're pinned on a corkboard in the foyer, four scraps of paper fluttering together, held by a single drawing pin that's probably still in use today. She knows what she's looking for. She knows what she will find. The dates align. She didn't realize it as she travelled back. The archived news story, the list of charges against him. And there it is. She barely has to scan down at all. R. and Joseph Jones, Courtroom 1. So this is a life lived in reverse. Things happened that Jen had no idea about, that passed her by as innocuously as cars. She heads into Courtroom 1 and sits in the public gallery. It smells of stale teapots, ancient books, dust and polish. It is busy, a high-profile trial that she had no idea about at the time, and why would she? She's lost Kelly. She has no idea in which capacity he is attending. As a friend of Joseph Jones, she assumes with a wince, an accomplice. The benches in the public gallery are laid out like pews. "All rise," a clerk says. He has reading glasses perched on the end of his nose, robes that sweep the cheap carpeted floors. Jen is embarrassed by the pomp and circumstance of the justice system that she's dedicated her life to. She gets to her feet as the judge arrives. She bows her head reflexively. The defendant, in handcuffs, is led in by a security guard with one delicate hoop earring in his ear and put in the dock. Joseph Jones, young 30-year-old Joseph. How strange it is to look at him and know the date on which, as things stand, he will die, Jen thinks, looking at those distinctive elfin ears, his goatee, his narrower shoulders, almost boy-like. He could be anyone's son. He could be Todd. The judge addresses the court. "Earlier, we finished hearing from the second witness for the prosecution, Witness A, and now we call the third," he says simply. The court is already in session. Jen works it through in her mind. So Kelly's last-minute conference must have been a witness summons. Trials never know which day they will need their witnesses on until the previous one finishes. "Thank you, Your Honour," a barrister says. A woman with retro-thick glasses. Her wig just covers their pale stems. Jen had forgotten it was the past until she saw those NHS glasses. They look almost like the ones kids wear today. Funny how fashion works. "We heard yesterday from Grace Ellencourt, HSBC employee, who confirmed that Joseph Jones regularly deposited and withdrew large sums of money into a company bank account." She looks pointedly at the jury. "We heard earlier from Witness A that he also regularly instructed his foot soldiers to steal cars. And to corroborate this, the state now calls the next witness to the stand, and for this, we must ask again that the jury and the public gallery temporarily depart." Jen's mind is whirring. The public gallery and jury out only indicates a few things: evidential issues, matters of law and procedure, admissibility arguments, and anonymous witnesses. Everybody except the lawyers leaves. Jen loiters, watching people who presumably have as much vested in this as she does, drinking vending machine coffee, talking, the same way they always have in courthouses. The only difference is fewer mobile phones. She pops outside, stands on the courthouse steps, wanting to witness the world here in its 2003 snapshot. She watches the cars, brand new looking, but old too. N-Reg, P-Reg. A lawyer stands nearby, smoking, just thinking. The buildings are the same, same sky, same sun. She met Kelly only the preceding March. Their relationship is hardly 6 months old. She spins in a slow circle. You wouldn't know. You wouldn't know. The world doesn't know how much it's changing. Jury back to courtroom one, an usher says from the foyer, and Jen heads inside, her eyes lingering on the city horizon for just a second. She's about to find something out, something she can never unknow. In the courtroom, her eyes take a second to adjust after the glare of the September sun, but after a moment she sees what she expects. The witness box has changed. It is secured by a black curtain. Witness B, the female barrister says, her voice as crisp and clear as a natural spring, is a serving undercover police officer. His anonymity, she addresses the jury, is to preserve his and the police's methods and working arrangements and his safety. So, now to witness B. You do not need to state your name for the record. How would you like to swear your oath? Whoever is behind the curtains says nothing. The barrister waits, then approaches the curtains after the silence throbs in the courtroom for too long. Jen holds her breath. Surely, surely, surely this is not her husband. The barrister re-emerges after a second and approaches the bench. Jen hears it, then a murmured discussion. He wants his voice anonymized. He's got an accent. We did make a formal application, the barrister is saying. Jen can't catch it all. She can only hear snatched phrases. She can only understand because she's a lawyer. But, Your Honour, in the interests of open justice, the other barrister says. Their debates continue in mumbled prose that Jen strains to hear. It's important in open court to be heard as you are, the judge announces after a few minutes more. Witness B, the oath, the barrister prompts. Wait, this witness is a witness for the prosecution, not the defence, so... Jen hears a sigh. A very, very distinctive, pissed-off sigh, and then a single word. Secular. Three syllables. And there it is, what Jen perhaps already knew. Kelly is witness B. She had it all wrong. Kelly isn't involved in crime. He had been trying to stop it. Day minus 6,998, 1100. I work with him, yes, Kelly's voice says, for several months last year. He has disguised his Welsh accent, smoothed it out like planing wood. Jen is fairly sure only she would know this was him, the verbal cues you pick up only through 20 years of marriage. And what was your role? The questions continue, even though Jen's mind is still trying to process it. The fact keeps repeating on her like shockwaves after an earthquake. He's a police officer. He was a police officer? Her eyes trail upwards to the tiny windows at the top of the courtroom. He never told her. He never told her. He never told her. He never told her. Her life is a lie. Thoughts gather around her like a crowd of reporters asking questions. How could he have kept this from her? Kelly! Her happy-go-lucky, trustworthy husband, Kelly. It doesn't even explain anything. Why are they seeing the repercussions of this lie 20 years later? Why is Todd involved? He never told her. He never told her. Jen puts her forehead in her hands. But then, isn't this truth more palatable than the other? Maybe, but being damned if you do and damned if you don't is still damned. I was assigned to infiltrate the organised crime gang the defendant was running, Kelly says dispassionately. God, it's mad. It's mad. And at what point were you dispatched? Kelly clears his throat. when the baby was stolen. Your Honour, the defence barrister, an elderly man says, immediately rising to his feet, please stick to the points in issue. When two foot soldiers stole a baby as part of the workings of the defendant's supply chain, Kelly clarifies acerbically. Your Honour, the barrister says again. Witness B, we respectfully ask that you stick to the facts at issue. This is not a kidnapping trial. We never found the perpetrators, Kelly says, but the defendant knows. Your Honour, witness B, the judge says, clearly exasperated now. Fine, Kelly says. Jen knows his teeth are gritted, hollows appearing underneath his cheekbones. He pauses, and she knows, too, that he will now be running a hand through his hair. Even this Kelly, who she hasn't seen for 20 years, even this Kelly, who she has, at this point, loved for only 6 months, this Kelly, who's been a liar from day one. A painter-decorator since age 16, both parents dead, never been to college, left school after GCSEs. How true is any of it? How can he be police? Why didn't he tell her? She would have understood. It's hardly a crime to have been an undercover police officer. She shifts uncomfortably in the public gallery, wishing she could cross-examine along with the barristers. I was instructed to find out the defendant's identity, Kelly says, and I did so by going in at the very bottom level of his gang. For reasons relating to my anonymity, I can't explain any further than that what my role was. What sort of tasks did you undertake for the defendant? For reasons relating to my anonymity, I can't explain any further than that what my role was. What did you witness the defendant directly doing? For reasons... The barrister sighs, clearly irritated. She takes off her glasses, cleans them theatrically on her robes, then puts them back on. For quite whose benefit, Jen isn't sure. I can tell you what I didn't do, Kelly says in a tone of voice Jen knows to precede something unhelpful. Yes, the barrister says. I didn't ever find the people who Joseph instructed to commit crimes, instructions that resulted in the kidnap of baby Eve. Right, the defence barrister jumps to his feet. The judge waves them over, casting a look to the troublemaking black curtains. Jury out, he says. They filter back out into the foyer, and after 10 minutes, an usher confirms the case is adjourned until tomorrow. Jen stands there, open-mouthed. What? She says. We're resuming again tomorrow, an usher says to her. A dismissal. Jen stands in the foyer, people milling around her like a school of fish. She doesn't have a tomorrow, she thinks desperately. It won't come. Kelly goes white when he sees Jen standing by his car. His cheeks sink, his lips blanch. His eyes dart left and right, then he smiles at her, trying to style it out. Jen watches him, this man who becomes her husband, lying to her. His suit is already rumpled, the jacket slung over his arm. He looks ill, pale and young, almost like a child, very much like Todd. I saw your testimony, she says simply. I was in the public gallery. Her body immediately wants to cry and to be comforted by this man she's loved for over half her life, the man she would always turn to. He looks up the high street into the sun, then gestures to his car. Is that it? She says to him. In the pause in which he considers which truths to tell and which to conceal, Jen tries to move the events in her brain so that they run forwards, not backwards. But she can't think, her mind a sea of disparate facts. Maybe it will end here, she thinks. She could break up with Kelly, but so many questions remain unanswered. She knows somehow, thanks to Andy maybe, that it isn't yet time. They get inside the car. The air outside is soupy, the seats warm against their thighs. He guns the engine and drives fast out of Liverpool. He still hasn't spoken. Kelly, she says. She hates that she has to prompt him. I mean, She tries to remember that they have only been in a relationship for 6 months, that he doesn't know the future, that they make it. They make it 20 happy years and counting. Somehow. He doesn't know the importance of what he is toying with, of what is at stake. Kelly says nothing. He navigates a one-way junction, eyes flicking to the rearview mirror. You're undercover police. He nods, just once, a downward bob of his head. Yeah. Were you undercover when you met me? Yes. Is your name Kelly? He waits a beat. No. He swallows, Adam's apple sliding up and down. How is this? How could you? Jen's mind is spinning, spinning, spinning in space, in the blackness. She can't string a sentence together. You've lied to me, Jen says slowly. It's confidential. Jen has so many questions, she doesn't know where to start. She is trying to marry up two things that simply do not go together. Kelly looks like he's going to cry, eyes red-rimmed, gaze scanning the horizon. She knows him. She knows when he's unhappy. My real name is Ryan, he says quietly. Kelly was someone I knew. Ryan. Things begin to fall into place. How? Jen starts to say, trying to frame it correctly. How do you intend to just live as Kelly? He shifts, uncomfortable. I don't know. Kill Ryan off? Fake his death? He turns to her in surprise. No? What? I don't know. I don't know what I'm going to do about it. Jen looks away from him, out of the window. Classic, evasive Kelly. Ignore the problem. Then, when it crops up, damage control. The abandoned house, sandalwood, makes more sense to her now. Gina thought Ryan Hiles was dead because it passed to the Crown, the same thing Rakish found. But there was no other record of Ryan Hiles's death. It seems obvious now. A fake death certificate, bought for the sole purpose of showing it to the land registry to ensure the property didn't pass to him and make him traceable, blowing his cover. But he didn't do anything else, didn't register his own death in any other way, which would have attracted scrutiny, required more documents, more things he couldn't produce. A body, for one. It was a sticking plaster over a huge wound. His mother must have died only recently. Sandalwood was only just beginning to fall into disrepair. Jen supposes that when he cried in the bathroom when Todd was three, his mother might have been alive, and he missed her. He looks at her. I left the police, he says. Last year, I stayed as Kelly because... Why? She says. Because I met you. But you could have... Couldn't you have told me? Or just chosen a new name? Joseph Jones believes I am a criminal called Kelly, he says quietly, so softly she has to strain to hear. If I change anything, or if I tell anyone... Word would get back to him that I was never Kelly. It would be the most obvious tale of all that I am undercover, so I have stayed. You stayed a criminal? So he thinks. But I'm not. I'm not doing anything. I decided I had better hide in plain sight. It'll be better when he's convicted, he says ruefully, but Jen knows that it isn't. Every prison sentence has an end, and by then it's too late. Ryan has truly become Kelly. What would the police do if they knew? Arrest me, probably, because I haven't been acting on their authority, for fraud by false representation. Maybe sue me, too. Say I was impersonating a police officer, get me on charges for misconduct in a public office. Jen is hot and panicked. This is so, so much bigger than she thought it would be. She closes her eyes. They'd arrest him not only for fraud, but also for those crimes he commits in 2022 to keep his cover. He will not be protected by immunity for those. He will be regarded as a criminal. When we went travelling, you didn't want to come back. You wanted to stay in the cottage, in the middle of nowhere, because of him. Yes, he knew two of his soldiers dobbed him in, a woman and a man. Nicola. Why didn't you ever tell me, she asks. Kelly's gaze moves off hers. Confidential, he says, his voice low. But, I mean, she can't say the things she wants to say. Does confidentiality apply between lovers? Why does he think it was acceptable to keep this from her forever? Because he hasn't lived forever yet, with her. Were you ever going to tell me, she says. Of course I was, Kelly says. I am. Jen marvels at their different tenses, hers past, his future. But it's a lie. Jen's lived it. The last piece of the puzzle finally drifts into place now, in the correct order, front to back, as it should be. Jen stares at it in her mind. Can I ask, she says, thinking of what Kelly just said about Joseph. Yeah? When Joseph gets out of prison, if he found out you were the copper who sent him down, what do you think he would do? He won't find out. The curtain, they disguise my voice. There were so many of us working for him, the scale of it. But say, somehow, he does. What then? Kelly waits a beat, then speaks. He'd come and kill me. Day minus 6,998, 2300. It's late. Jen is in the bath. She can't wait to go to sleep and wake up someplace else, tomorrow. A hot pool of confusion gathers in her stomach. Undercover. Undercover. The word, ugly and huge, thrums underneath Jen's breastbone like a heartbeat. So this is why. No PAYE job, no social media, no parties. Kelly has been living under an assumed identity for 20 years. But why did he never tell her? She thinks she has pieced it together into the right order. She wishes she could ask Andy, but he won't even have finished his degree yet. Not even he can help her now. She stares at the frosted window, thinking it through. Kelly went undercover. His evidence sent Joseph to prison. 20 years later, Joseph is released, comes looking, at the law firm, for Kelly, trying to start up his crime ring once again, with all the old players in it. If Kelly refused to obey Joseph, Joseph would suspect he was the undercover officer. If he complied, he became a criminal, proper. Kelly couldn't win. And since Joseph served 20 years for the crimes he committed with many of his foot soldiers, he had a hold over all of them if they didn't comply. He could hand them in. Only over Kelly, he had an even greater hold, so great he didn't even know it. If he reported Kelly for his past crimes, then the police would come looking and find out Kelly was still living under his assumed identity, illegally. Or worse, that he was committing offences now, without the authority of the police. Hence the package passed, containing the stolen car key. Kelly was forced to comply. Todd was there when they met again, as was Cleo, and they fell in love. Kelly told Todd not to tell Jen about him knowing Joseph, and he also later told Todd to finish it with Cleo. He must have confessed all that night in the garden, told Todd who he really was. The most fucked up thing Todd had ever had happen to him, he had said. He must have shown him his old badge, the poster. Jen can just imagine it now, the conversation taking place in Todd's room, Todd hiding the badge, phone and poster from her. Kelly began working for Joseph again, but at the moment he thought Joseph might know he was the policeman who put him in prison, he desperately contacted Nicola for help, who is not, as it turned out, a criminal, but somebody who had been undercover back then, police. He must have felt between a rock and a hard place. In fear for his life, coming clean to Nicola must have been the least bad option. In return for her silence, and because of the risk of Joseph finding them, she asked Kelly for a favour. This must have been for Kelly to pass information to the police about Joseph's ongoing crimes. Maybe she arranged protection for Kelly, and that's why Jen saw the police cars circulating. Maybe that's why they arrived so soon on that night, way before the ambulance. They were waiting to intervene, but just too late. Too late. Nicola must have been harmed by Joseph 2 nights before Todd commits his crime. The Section 18 wounding with intent Jen overheard in the police station. Joseph must have worked her out. Now out of prison, he would have been watching every single contact of his for signs they were not who they said. It would have been easier to work her out as police, given she never left. That's why Nicola looked so different in Wagamama's. She wasn't in her undercover role. And figuring out Nicola will have led Joseph to Kelly. So Joseph finds out and comes for Kelly in the middle of the night at the end of October. And wasn't he armed? Didn't he reach into his pocket for a weapon? The police appeared almost immediately after the murder. They probably already knew something was brewing. And then they betrayed Kelly. They arrested Todd, even though Kelly had asked Nicola for help. No wonder he was furious at the station. And what of Todd? Well, it seems so simple now that Jen knows. He wanted to protect his father. So on hearing about Nicola, he bought a knife. On his way home, he recognized Joseph, saw he was armed, and panicked. Then he did the only thing he could. Protected his dad. At all costs. Ryan. 718 Welbeck Street. That's the address Joseph has given Ryan and Angela. They're ready to go. Angela's going to keep a watch outside and Ryan's going in. And afterwards, the rest of the squad is going to arrest Joseph now that Angela and Ryan can identify him. He's trusted Ryan and Angela, and as a result, there's enough to incriminate him. The text message, Ryan and Angela's evidence, it will be enough to demonstrate he was running a crime ring, enough to send him down for decades. The only thing missing is the baby. Still lost. As they're walking over, another message appears. Go into the address in the previous text and say you're here to do painter decorating. Once you get to the proprietor's office, say I sent you. JJ. Ryan turns to Angela. This is it, he says. This is how he gets the addresses of the empty houses. This office. We've got him. We've fucking got him. I know, Angela says, buzzing. I know. Ryan and Angela walk along the rainy March streets, Ryan thinking of his brother, and of old Sandy, too, thinking about how he kind of has changed the world, just a little bit, in his own small way. Ryan blinks back some emotion or other that he can't name. They reach the address. Nicola walks away from him, perfectly in character, leaving Ryan to enter the building. A law firm, apparently, looks well-to-do. A woman is sitting in reception. She's pretty. Cascades of dark hair, big eyes. Need any painting or decorating done? He says, a big, fixed, hopeful smile in place. What, just spontaneous decorating? She says with a dry laugh. Something turns over in his stomach at that laugh. He didn't expect this. He thought she'd be in on it. He thought she'd understand the code. Yeah, he says. Sure, we'll just pull all the furniture away from the walls right now then, shall we? Do the legal work while you paint? Okay, I'm game if you are, he says easily. We're all right, thanks, she says. But if we ever want some unplanned decorating done, you're our man. She ignores him, turning her gaze back to her computer. Can I just check with the owner? He asks. How do you know I'm not the owner? Well, are you? No. They hold each other's gazes for a second, then explode into laughter. Well, pleased to meet you, not the owner, he says. Likewise, spontaneous decorator. She smiles at him, like they know each other, and shouts over her shoulder. Dad, she says, someone here for you? She glances at Ryan just as he heads into her father's office. I'm Jen. Kelly.